Welcome to the weekly Dharma Talk podcast from the Columbus Karma Teksum Choling Buddhist Meditation Center. This week's Dharma Talk is entitled Jewel Ornament of Liberation, Chapter 2, by Eric Weinberg. We have all been through difficulties in our lives, however, we still have great potential. In fact, the life we have now is full of promise for the future. This chapter describes the preciousness of our life and how it can be the vehicle for spiritual transformation. If you like our Dharma Talk series, please consider donating to Columbus Karma Teksum Choling at columbusktc.org. Enjoy the podcast.
Well, good morning, everybody. I think this is exactly 11:30 according to the atomic clock, wherever that is. So, you know, precise and all that. This is the 11:30 Dharma Talk from Columbus KTC. Welcome to everybody from everywhere. And I personally want to thank you for joining us for this. Right now, we are studying this book, which is called The Jewel Ornament of Liberation by Gyanpopa, which was his text of step-by-step instructions for how to actually complete the Buddhist path, which is a pretty wonderful thing. So he takes us from the very beginning. Last week, he starts, it's a logical progression. So last week, we started with what's called the primary cause. And the primary cause is Buddha nature itself. The idea behind it is that we actually possess already the same nature as Gautama, Shakyamuni, the Buddha of our age. And because we already possess that nature, we have the potential of realizing the same thing, the same level of enlightenment that he did. Now, this week, we're going to talk about the working basis. So it's one thing to have the potential, but we need to have a working basis for all of this. And that's called, what he calls it, is the precious human life. I want to say from the beginning that having my Western mind prejudice, when I first heard these teachings a long time ago, I was a little confused because I was in the, I'm a tree-hugging liberal from way back, and my idea is that all life is precious. So I didn't really get the gist of what Gyanpopa was talking about here. And while it's true that all life, literally all life in this world and in all worlds, possess the potential for awakening, which we call Buddha nature, all that's true. Not all life has all the qualities and conditions necessary for realization. So what precious Buddha nature is referring to is that if we have the working basis to really tread this path in this lifetime, we shouldn't waste it because it is rare and it is precious and it is distinctive. It's different. So on the one hand, it is incumbent upon us to be kind and compassionate and helpful in every way we possibly can to every living being that there possibly is. Because everything is with Buddha nature is worthy of that respect and that care. The preciousness isn't in this case so much that our life is worth more than somebody else's life. That's not it. Or that there's one life that's precious and one life that's not in terms of value. That's not it. This preciousness actually is called the working basis because it actually entails responsibility. If we are lucky enough, fortunate enough to have all these endowments, and they literally call them endowments and freedoms, that allow us to practice well in this lifetime, we should not miss the chance to do it, because who knows when all those things will come together in that way again. So this is a very logical step-by-step description of what those freedoms and endowments are. And I've taken notes because, like many Buddhist texts, there's 8 of these and 10 of those and 5 of this and 2 of that and so on and so forth. And the point is not actually, just so you know, that we remember all this so we can pass a test or an SAT at the end, or that we study it all enough that they're completely memorized. The point of this is that this is also step-by-step meditation. So here's something that's not in the chapter that a lot of you know and some of you don't, so I'll just share it with you. There's this set of practices called the preliminaries, or nundro in Tibetan. And there are 4 ordinary preliminaries and 4 extraordinary preliminaries. Contemplation of precious human birth is the first of the 4 ordinary preliminaries. And according to the great Drikung, founder of the Drikung Kagyu, Jigten Sumgun, while all Vajrayana practices are of extreme value, the preliminaries are of the most valuable. And of the preliminaries, the ordinary preliminaries are the most valuable of those. And this is the first of the 4 ordinary preliminaries. It is, because it's the working basis, it is of extraordinary importance. And so each of these points I go through actually has a meditation or a contemplation attached to it. We don't have time to go through each of the parts of what's actually in the chapter and the attendant meditation, but I'll mention some of them and as we go along. And if you're curious and you want to continue to look at this, because it is of extraordinary value in building a strong and healthy foundation for your spiritual practice, you can look it up and you can just look up any, you know, there are wonderful books on Nundro. I'm trying to remember. Mindy Rinpoche wrote one that I particularly like recently, and I've forgotten the title off the top of my head, but if you look up Nundro and Mindy Rinpoche, you'll find it online. And so if you want to pursue this further than what we can do in an hour this morning, please look for a good quality commentary on Nundro and the particularly the ordinary preliminaries. So that's by way of introduction. Let's begin, as we always do, with chanting the refuge prayer together three times. I think it's particularly important to recognize that that we are offering refuge to ourselves. So we're recognizing the great good fortune of having a Buddha that teaches, that has come to this world, and that the teachings still exist for us, and we take refuge in the teacher and his teachings. And those that have followed those teachings for all these years, and certainly those in our midst that are our companions. And then internally, it's important to feel that, you know, to feel what it's like to be in the presence of an enlightened being, in the presence of those teachings, and in the presence of companions who are doing their best to step by step follow those teachings. And the third, to take refuge in the energy that even the livingness itself, this sense of preciousness of this life that contains all these incredible freedoms and all these incredible assets. I'm going to chant it in Tibetan, and you can follow along in your heart in whichever way you like, or if you like to sing along, please do, and mute your mic, though, because the timing of Zoom will throw us all into chaos if we overhear each other chanting. Sanje Chudang Suki Chognam Changju Pardu Dakni Gyab Suchi Daki Jin Suki Pe Sonam Ki Drola Pinchir Sanje Drupar Shom Sanje Chudang Suki Chognam Changchu Pardu Dagni Kyab Suchi Dagi Jin So Ki Pe Sonam Ki Drola Penchir Sanje Drupar Shum Sanje Chudang So Ki Chok Nama Changchu Pardu Dagni Kyab Suchi Daki jin so ki pe sunam ki Roll up and shear Sanje Drupar Shom. Thank you. So, we all have Buddha nature. All humans, all living beings, animals, insects, everything with life, regardless of species or race or ethnicity or politics. And so all are worthy of respect. So what makes for preciousness? What's different between a life and a precious human birth? Why make the distinction? Why even bother ourselves with it? Those are important questions. That's questions, as I mentioned, I asked myself once I knew enough to ask myself after I got over my assumptions. And the reason is that we have this potential, but we all also have this egocentrism, the sense of I, me, and mine, the sense of self, which drives us to believe that causes for lasting well-being, authentic well-being, which is what we all really want. We want to feel well and happy, and that it can last. And this egocentrism that we have actually is a little voice in our head that says, well, we don't have it yet, but if we do this, this, and this, or if we get this, this, and this, or involve ourselves with this, this, and this, we can get it. And we miss, right from the beginning, when we start in that direction, we miss the truth that it's already there, that it's already within us. And so we end up, from literally from birth, trying to get what we want but don't have, and trying to get rid of what we don't want that we do have. And our lives can get pretty busy with that. The Dharma is basically saying to us, happiness is an inside job. And the direct experience of happiness, of authentic, lasting well-being, is possible. But it's a matter of going in and working with all the things that are obstructing or obscuring that Buddha nature that rests in the core of our very being, not in the new car, not in a better house, and not in a membership to the country club, or even not in, you know, whatever it is that you can find outside yourself. Certainly, if you're wise, you can accumulate some things that actually support this journey inward. Certainly, there's nothing wrong with that and desiring those things. But let's face it, we do get distracted, we do get deluded, and oftentimes we're not wise enough to discern what's really helpful and what's not. And that's why these step-by-step instructions by someone who has realized them, Gampopa, are so valuable. So he's going to delineate for us some of these things in detail. And he said, or Trungpa Rinpoche and his commentary on this, is that one of our first obstacles, one of our first hindrances, is that we easily get discouraged. You know, it's one thing to go, especially these days with so many raw emotions flying around, to go for what some people call shopping therapy, you know, going on Amazon and buying yourself a little something, something. Or if you're brave enough to venture to a store, you know, masking up and all of that, and going to a store and buying yourself something. And of course, it makes you happy. There are all those things that we want to feel there. We have some control, some choice, some, you know, I can do this and get what I want, and so on and so forth. But, you know, after a while, it just becomes a thing in the house. And eventually, when it's time to move, it becomes a real pain in the butt, because you either have to move it or give it away or throw it in the trash. And so, you know, this is a repeated pattern. And somehow we never get discouraged of trying that. I often think of it as, you know, that's the muscle we've built. For some reason, we've engaged the logic of materialism and accept it as almost a scientific kind of truth, whereas the truth of Buddha nature, we kind of can forget that. Or when we do try a little meditation and it doesn't go the way we want it to, we can easily get discouraged and give up. So one of the reasons that the first things that are taught are Buddha nature and precious human birth are as a reminder that it's worth it. And don't get discouraged, because when you really directly experience what is actually true, you'll have that which you seek, which is lasting, authentic well-being. So we have to explore this right basis or this foundation, because in a sense, we have to convince ourselves. The end of this talk, we get to talking about faith and what we have faith in and the different kinds of faith. And that's what this is all about. It's like giving yourself enough direct experience to get through this, what shall I say, discouragement or negative self-image, or, you know, I'm not good enough. I don't really, you know, I'm not worthy. What was it? There was a Mike Myers thing. We are not worthy. You remember that? Something like that. Well, the truth is we are worthy, but we got to do a little work. I used to ask the question, okay, I got to do some work, but, you know, answer me this. If we already have it, why aren't we Buddhas already after so many previous lives? And Trungpa Rinpoche says, up until now, we probably haven't found ourselves in a human life with all the right conditions to realize and to achieve realization. But we have them now. So we should take advantage of this opportunity. It's so rare. So, in the first of the four preliminaries, which are part of the daily practice of people on the path, is this contemplation of the formal contemplation of the preciousness of human life. Gampopa's framework is in 5 points. To refer to the physical aspect of precious human birth, and 3, refer to the mental aspect of precious human birth. The two physical aspects are called the 8 freedoms and the 10 endowments. Just to make sure that we have definition, because we all have our own definitions of freedom. That's certainly apparent these days. And we all have our own definition of what endowments are. And what Gampopa says is freedoms are the absence of unfavorable conditions. Freedoms are opportunities. So of those 8 freedoms, 3 of them are referring to the Buddhist wheel of life. I'm sure that you've seen pictures of this where there are what are called the 6 realms of samsara. So there's a hell realm where beings inhabiting that realm are always in a state of extreme cold or extreme heat and suffering, so much suffering that there's no way to gather the awareness, attention, and so on to really go inward. It's just too overwhelming all the time. The second, and we're not there. We're really, really lucky to not be there. The second is the hungry ghost realm, where there are beings there that are always in a state of craving. They're always hungry. They're always thirsty. There's never enough. One of the visual depictions of them is that their mouths and their throats are just hair thin, you know, like a capillary tube in thinness, and their bellies and their capacity are huge. So even if they're in front of absolutely what they need, they can't take it in, and yet they'll always crave it. It's excruciatingly full of suffering. And we're not there. And then there are the animal realms. And we love animals. But it's really, really clear that animals are completely the servants of their senses. They're reactive to whatever happens. You know, it's like in that movie Up, which I love dearly. I suppose it's on Netflix. I don't know, but we could watch it again. There's a dog there, and he'll be doing his dog thing and even helping, you know, his master. And he's certainly one of the stars. But then right in the middle of something, he'll go, squirrel. It's what animals have to do. They're just wired that way. And we're not. By developing real mindfulness, we can see a stimulus coming through our senses as a stimulus coming through our senses and say, ah, I see a squirrel there, and let it go and return to this stream of consciousness that we're in, or dissolve that, let it go into bare awareness, and simply be energy in our atmosphere. Animals can't do that. Okay. So we're not there. And then the fourth one is that we're not, in one of the God realms. The God realms are like extraordinary. There's so much happiness there. And there's one mistake. There's so much happiness there that one doesn't want for anything. One has a sense of lasting well-being. And so one doesn't want to practice. There's no motivation there. There's no sense of anything lacking. There's no sense of any potential. It all appears to be realized. But the mistake is that attachment, when things are that good, attachments develop. And then, because everything is impermanent, everything is. Eventually, all those good conditions and those good circumstances melt away like a cloud in the sky goes to nothing. And the crash off of that is incredible. I've heard Trungpa Rinpoche say that actually, while in the God realm you think you have the best of the best, and in a sense you do, the suffering of the God realm is the greatest of all. Because the fall from having everything you think you want to less than nothing at all is just excruciating. And I think we can all relate to that, you know, in small ways. When things fall apart for us in this life, we almost have more than we can stand, eh? And for somebody who's in an even higher realm, it's even more profound. So those are the four external freedoms. We're free of being in those four realms. Now there are four freedoms in the human realm. We're free of living in a world or in a country or in a county or a town that's only full of what Gampopa called barbarians. Barbarians are people who are just, you know, quintessentially ignorant and mostly involved in, you know, practicing harm of others in order to enrich themselves, not recognizing interdependence or their connection with everything, or not even recognizing that there is anything beyond themselves. They just kind of pile harm on top of harm and lie on top of lie. And if you're born into a community like that, and you never, ever can meet the Dharma or even science or any kind of spiritual truth in that world, and you just grow up kind of as a feral human, you won't have one of the freedoms necessary in order to recognize, in order to realize a precious human birth. Then there are persons with the wrong view. You know, there are wrong views. There's a lot of different wrong views that are delineated. But, you know, in general, not recognizing interdependence is a wrong view. Not recognizing that what we think, do, and say matters, that there's cause and effect. And by what we think, do, and say, we're creating the conditions for what's next. That's a wrong view. Thinking that your happiness is going to come from outside of yourself, that's a wrong view. And it goes on and on, but you get the idea. That's the second freedom in the human realm, is that we actually are around a lot of people that have what in the Eightfold Noble Path is called the right view. The third freedom is that we haven't been born where no Buddha has appeared or taught. Actually, Gautama, Shakyamuni, was born and he did teach. And those that have followed him have continued the lineage of what he shared. And so we have a complete path open to us so that we ourselves can experience authentic, lasting well-being, precious human life. And the fourth one is that we haven't been born with handicaps that are so severe, whether they be physical or mental handicaps, that we can't absorb the Dharma. That's incredible. When you look around you, you know there are so many people who don't get that good fortune. And of course, they deserve every bit of our effort to support them and love them and serve them in every way that we can. But in terms of being able to have what they need in order to practice this path, that wasn't given to them in this life. So those are the eight freedoms. It's interesting. It's not freedom to do this or freedom to do that, the way we usually think of it. It's freedom from things that we lack, we could lack, in order to engage this path of Dharma. So then there are the 10 endowments. Endowments are defined as the presence of the right conditions for practice. Five, allow for the Dharma, and they come from within us. And five, allow for the Dharma, and they come from others. From ourselves, first of all, we were born human beings. Human beings have a particular kind of consciousness that's particularly conducive to this Dharma. And so that's a good thing. The next is we're living in a place with authentic teachings. Well, we're here, and I don't know how well I'm representing these, but you know, Lama Kathy is great, Lama Tom, Lama Adam, Kempo Kartha Rinpoche, I think was an emanation of Gampopa himself. I got that feeling when he used to teach these things. It was extraordinary. So at least I'm hoping I pass some of that energy along to you. It's incredible to be in a world, you know, our own little world where there are authentic teachings. And, you know, word to the wise, I take all of them in you can and work with all of them you can, because they're rare. The third is that all of your faculties function in a way that you can practice. In other words, you can sit and learn to meditate, or you can walk and learn to meditate, because we need to really build some skills that we aren't born with in order to practice this path and gain this realization. Our reactivity that we're born with, you know, it's like once we're out of our mother's womb and the umbilical cord is cut, we might not have any consciousness whatsoever until we have some sensation, like, for instance, I'm hungry, or that light is too bright, and we'll cry and people will try to take care of us. So right from the beginning, our first mind training is actually reacting to outside circumstances. It takes a while in terms of development. The developmental psychologists tell us it takes a while in order to come to the place where we can begin to look inward. So having the faculties that function in a way that we can practice is an extraordinary endowment. The fourth is free from wrong livelihoods. You know, actually, if our lives are taken up with destroying things or killing things or stealing from people or, you know, doing any of the 10 unvirtuous things, and we make a living that way and therefore become very attached to it, that's a problem. And we'll have to rectify that before we can go very far on the path. I myself, some of you know that I'm a registered investment advisor. When I first got in to the business, I was a broker. I had to change that because brokers want to sell stuff for a commission, and the motivation is all towards, if you can sell stuff, you can make a living. And you don't worry too much about what the stuff is. I had to leave that behind in order to progress on the path, to be honest with you. Now, you know, I'm in one of those situations where if I do well for my clients, I do well for myself. If I don't do well for my clients, I don't do well for myself. And in that way, we're connected, which is a reflection of reality. And it engages the possibility of compassion arising in the heart. Whereas if you have to just get something from somebody and move on to the next one, you know, that gets in the way. So there are millions of professions like that. I just thought I'd mention that because it's my own direct experience that I had to go through this, letting go of what I was doing in order to do something else. The fifth one is to be interested in the truth and have faith in it. Accomplishing enlightenment relies completely on ourselves. No one else can do it for us. We can say the right mantra in just the right way, or the right prayer in just the right way, and so on and so forth. And Buddha or God or whoever might want to give us a great boon and drop enlightenment on our head. It doesn't matter. It won't help, and it won't work. It all has to come from within ourselves. In fact, I would imagine that Buddha is actually blessing us right now with energy that could awaken us at any moment, but our own obscurations and obstacles get in the way. And that's why we're on this graded path of the jewel ornament of liberation. That's why we do these meditations step by step, is to clear away this this connection we have with enlightened energy, so that it's not obstructed or hindered or obscured anymore. So I made a note to myself here that that's the first step, is recognizing that it depends on us, and in fact others are depending on us to do this. The first step is so important that Suzuki Roshi said in Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind, that we should actually strive to always be beginners. In other words, we should always be contemplating the preciousness of this life with its freedoms and endowments, so that we don't waste it, that we get every bit of juice out of this grape. So those are the five we get from ourselves. From others, the Buddha must have come to the world we live in for us. And for us, it was Gotama, Shakyamuni. And second, the Buddha must give teachings. Just because there's a Buddha around doesn't necessarily mean they're going to teach. Three, the teachings must still be present in our lifetime. Because even the Dharma is impermanent. We can see this. There are so many lineages of truth spiritualities that have been cut off. And certainly the Chinese tried to do that to the Tibetan lineages. Their survival is just extraordinary. And we are very lucky to have benefited from the fact that they're still present. And that's true of the other lineages as well. One of the things that Adolf Hitler tried to do to Judaism was first kill all the rabbis and burn all the books. That's what Kristallnacht was all about, was burning all the books. He wanted to break the lineage. And to some degree, he did. Some of the deepest spiritual lineages of Judaism, the internal practices, are no longer here. We can read about them, but they're not living masters anymore who can pass them on to us. So we've got to absolutely cherish the fact that there are living masters of this authentic lineage that are teaching and are passing them on to us. We can't waste this opportunity. So these masters, the fourth one is that these masters give us the opportunity to follow the path. And the fifth one is that they're willing to guide us once we are on the path. This is really important to understand. Because of that egocentricism that I first mentioned, we easily get off kilter. We easily make mistakes, even when we think we're doing things perfectly and we do things right. We can't see what we can't see. So a fair witness, a good spiritual friend who's helping us and is outside of us and can see our predicament or where we might be stuck, they can point that out. It doesn't have to be harsh. It's a gentle thing. It's a kind thing. And we can have an aha moment and say, oh. And in that sense, be instantly helped and create even a deeper connection with the Dharma, with the teacher, and so forth, and with the activity in our own life that's bringing us along this path to authentic well-being. So, Gampopa says, in this sense, precious human life is better than any jewel you can ever own, better than any gold you can ever own. Because with it, you can cut the root of suffering and you can plant a viable seed for future happiness. It would be foolish to ignore it, or worse, to sell out. So, you know, there's a little, you know, repetition of that theme where he says, you know, this is like a vehicle, a boat crossing a sea of suffering. It's like a seed that's planted, a viable seed that's planted. As we all know, when a seed gets the right conditions, warmth, water, sunlight, and so on, it'll sprout. And the seed itself, of course, changes form dramatically. When a root gets thrown down, that seed husk is shattered. And there's a new thing there. And then when the first shoots poke up above the earth, there's a new thing there. And from a seedling to a sapling to a great tree and so on, there's constant transformation before the truth of what was inside that seed is revealed. But step by step, it will be revealed and eventually, you know, produce other good seeds, maybe good fruit, and so on and so forth. Lastly, he calls it a servant. And this is probably the most important thing. It's important to remember that this life is our servant. We can use it in order, because of the freedoms and endowments, we can use it. We can use our own mind to travel this path that we so much want to travel. However, it's a lousy master because that way that we get knocked off kilter all the time of wanting what we don't have and not wanting what we do have. And, you know, it's a constant reactivity that through meditation we can learn to recognize and let go of and, you know, get the good of it, get the energy out without having the reactivity drive us this way and that. Our aspiration for enlightenment is what needs to drive us forward. Our motivation to benefit ourselves and all beings through achieving enlightenment is what guides us forward. It's not this reactivity to whatever we're thinking or feeling in a given moment. We learn to recognize those as thoughts and feelings, and we learn to discern along the way which thoughts and feelings are helpful to this aspiration for enlightenment and motivation to benefit others, and which ones get in the way. And so we begin to learn to be inhabiting what's called discriminating wisdom. So there are three points of the mental aspect, and this gets to the faith part. So the first one is called trusting faith or confidence. You have to put yourself into positions where you can have experiences that build your confidence. There's no doubt about that. And generally, because we're babies on the path, if we just try to do it ourselves, that's difficult. Having experiences within a community, a sangha, very, very helpful. Actually meeting somebody who's accomplished the path, like Kempo Kartha Rinpoche or someone like that. And once we're rebuilt, I'm sure that there'll be lamas like that that will come and visit and teach. That was one of the big things for me when I first met Kempo Kartha Rinpoche. One of the immediate senses I got was, I want to be like him when I grow up. That's trusting confidence. So when he told me, yeah, okay, do this practice, do it this way, think about these things, think about them from this point of view, I had confidence, trusting confidence in that, because I could see the result. Then there's longing faith. Once you get a taste of it like that, you get really, really interested and you really, really long for the result. You want to grow up. And it's important to do that because that gives you some real jet fuel for your practice. Trungpa Rinpoche makes the point that there's this, in Lhasa, Tibet, there's this great, huge statue called the Jowo. It's a big statue of the Buddha. And it's considered sacred, and it's very, very old. So there are people from where he's from in Kham, which is, I don't know, 1,000 miles away, that will prostrate all the way to Lhasa just to come to the Jowo and be in the presence of this statue of the Buddha because of the energy that's there. And he said, and there are people in Lhasa who live next door that never see it in their whole lifetime. And that's because they have never developed this longing faith. How wonderful it would be to have these supports for our practice right next door. And hopefully Columbus KTC, when it's rebuilt, will be that. That's our deepest wish, is that it is that for people. But we have to long for accomplishing this well-being that we wish for. And lastly is clear faith. And that's when you start to get a little experience and you really begin to appreciate the power and the efficacy of the Dharma. And you begin to have a lot of faith in it. You see how things unfold and you can see they're in the right direction. And along with that, of course, once you see that, is this enormous gratitude. And out of that gratitude, you know, prayer can be simple. It can be two words. It can be the only prayer you have at that point. And that prayer is, thank you. So much gratitude for this. So, those are the three points of the mental aspect. Lastly, he says, this is the way he presented it. Lastly, he presented, what are the impediments to faith? And he said, there are four, and we need to know them because faith, when we have it, has a certain fragility. It can change, and it can be degraded. It can disappear. So the first impediment is desire. We might give up faith in our practice because of some perceived benefit somewhere else. And out of the desire for whatever that is, you know, could be to be more popular with somebody who's doing something else. So I'm going to give up on this. That's an impediment. It's a problem. The next is anger. And the problem with anger, even when we're getting angry with people who just are deluded by benighted ignorance, it closes our mind down. You can feel it every time you're angry. Anger consumes space. Rather than opening you, it closes you. You can feel the contraction. And if you stay angry for a long time, you contract, you lose the space within which your practice can live, or anything else that's wholesome for that matter. So we have to learn how to work with that. Of course, fear. Fear of being harmed, jailed, killed. A lot of that, the Tibetans understand this because in 1959, with the Chinese invasion, so many were harmed and killed and jailed. And one of the stipulations of the Chinese literally was, you got to give up practicing Buddhism or we'll kill you. There are a lot of lamas that I've met, a handful that I've met that were in Chinese jails and tortured, but they never stopped practicing, even though it was a threat of death. And in fact, one of my most beloved teachers, Garchen Rinpoche, actually got most of the transmission that he teaches during the years that he was in Chinese prison camp and being tortured. He also in that camp, by good fortune, was his guru. And his guru, because they were together for a long time, even in those unfavorable circumstances, was able to transmit the lineage that Garchen Rinpoche teaches to him. And we have it here today because Garchen Rinpoche did not allow fear to be an impediment to his faith. And in fact, it just made him stronger because he used the Dharma to overcome those circumstances, and he found strength in himself that he didn't know he had. It's beautiful when he tells stories about that. And the last is, of course, ignorance, which is basic stupidity. And if somebody convinces you that you or your practice or your faith and all of that is a waste of time, a big mistake, and all of that, if you've got it, your practice and what you're working on from an authentic source, it would just be stupid to allow yourself to be convinced of that. But ignorance is a thing, and people do try to convince you of that from time to time. They'll debate you. And so it's important to recognize that those things will arise and they're just impediments to the faith that we need to progress on the path. So I've spent the whole time here going through that. It was a lot of material, a lot of 10 of this and 8 of that and 4 of the other thing. I hope it was of some benefit to you. I hope that I hope that you can contemplate what this precious human life that you've gotten, and it becomes a deep river of support and energy for your practice. I've got a couple minutes, literally a couple, for any questions that have come up. I'm happy to answer them.
Eric, just a quick one. Here's the book I think you were mentioning, even though the text is backwards, Turning Confusion into Clarity.
Yes, thank you.
Yeah.
Wonderful book. Thank you, Tanya. Well, if there are not any questions, which is perfectly fine with me, let's just dedicate the merit of having gathered together Just take a minute and just feel all the energy of all of us that have gotten together to hear this teaching on the words of Gampopa and Trungpa Rinpoche. And allow the gratitude for that to arise in you as light that you send from yourself to bless all living things in all worlds. May the merit of getting together and spending an hour hearing and contemplating, meditating on the Dharma, touch the lives of all beings without exception, and bring happiness and its causes, remove suffering and its cause, spread a sense of joy and lasting, durable peace. At this very moment, may the people and nations of this earth not even hear the words disease, famine, war, or suffering. May pure conduct, merit, wealth, and prosperity increase. And may supreme well-being and good fortune always arise. Hey, good to see you all on this Sunday. Thank you so much for coming. Means a lot to me. I'm just grateful to be connected to all of you.
Thank you for joining us for this week's Dharma Talk. We hope you enjoyed the podcast. If you did, please subscribe, rate, and review it on iTunes. To learn more about the Columbus Karma Teksum Choling or to donate to support our Dharma Talk series, please visit our website at columbusktc.org. The opening and closing music for the podcast is Tibetan Flute Song by Tamding Arts at tamdingarts.com. Please join us again next week for another Dharma Talk.